You are listening to a Triple Canopy podcast. To hear more, visit www.canopycanopycanopy.com.
Hi.
Hi, Malik.
Thank you for joining us to watch Trisha's wedding. I was sort of going around the room before this, kind of disavowing the film to everyone in person, but I enjoyed it quite a lot. The book that tracks a kind of language of Black radical politics and performances of the 60s around a transnational circuit that goes from the States to Ghana to West Germany and back to the States, and pays attention to the ways Black political language and international leftist language were borrowing from each other, adapting each other, stealing from each other, appropriating each other, and the way that tension plays out in performances. And the book sort of ends with this riotous scene of the Cockettes troupe in the Bay Area, just a short-lived, very productive group of incredible people at the end of the 60s in the Haight-Ashbury scene. And Sylvester, of course, is the figure I track the most in the chapter. And Sylvester maintains dignity somehow in this movie. Like, as Coretta King and the glamorous ambassadress of Ghana, so we can talk about that. But that's what we're watching, and that's where it's coming from. And so I asked Thomas to join me, and I'm so happy that you did. Thank you for coming.
I'm thrilled to be invited to talk to you, Malik. This book is so beautiful. I just want to thank you first for writing it. It's a pleasure to read it. It's, all of the joy and riotous energy in here in the book. The ideas are precise and chewy, but also just exquisite in its writing. So thank you for contributing, giving it to us. Appreciate it.
On sale in the back of the room.
Plug. And also
great
thanks
for a syllabus.
Thanks also Molly and Triple Canopy for having us here to celebrate, and Milo as well for all of the work to get us to the stage. Should we start with Sylvester's Black excellence in the film, to quote an updated version, hashtag Beyonce. Because I think that's, what's so great about what you do in the book is you focus in on very specific moments. And I guess just to pull out for a second, to have watched that, I think I situate your book, I think about your book in relationship to history of Black Marxism. And two terms that are in some kind of, magnetic refusal of one another. And part of a long history across the 20th century of thinking through aesthetics and a kind of cultural tradition. But this is a kind of unlikely object which within that trajectory. I mean, thinking about like C.L.R. James and, Richard Wright, Du Bois, I don't quite see this work easily fitting into the received version of Black Marxism that we have, yet nevertheless, you make an argument through the 60s that thinks about these two terms together. So maybe just can you talk about your version of that?
I mean, I think once you get to performance, right, things change. I mean, you name a bunch of these important, incredible, ambitious, masculinist political movers who had, through incredible invention, some mobility, did some incredible writing, circulated around, from the Caribbean to the United States to Europe, and created a kind of Pan-African network, or created independent West African states, or and they have to have a kind of seriousness about what they're doing, and particularly with Marxism, right? Like Nkrumah makes up his own version of African Marxism to rest a kind of Ghanaian nation-state project on. And of course, Marxism itself has all of its presumed orthodoxies that, you know, people conflict over to this day. And I was really thinking about the way performance exceeds the kind of political constraints that those systems set up. And, you know, very much thinking past the point of, like, how do we, for example, in many of those projects, how do we approach the kind of subject with rights that European philosophy demands but prohibits for black subjects, or black non-subjects, as Fred Moten might say. That struggle, that like tension that animates Du Bois's double consciousness and everything else, is sort of beyond, beside the point. Once you get to this place where you can play four different characters, you can wear whatever or not wear whatever, you can appropriate and adapt and transform pre-existing performance materials, you can satirize them, make them ironic, you can have a very ambivalent approach to them. And so I was trying to think about what performance allows to pass that place of impossibility where the kind of black political project brings you.
The idea of ambivalence is something that you return to a lot in the book, and I think in many ways structures both the relationship between those two terms, blackness and Marxism, in the way that you tell it, but also even your own relationship to that conjuncture. And I guess I just want to hear you talk a little bit more about your idea of radical ambivalence. I mean, I think for me, the moment where I understand that for myself is in that procession, mm-hmm. which is like such a kind of enactment and performance of a gender binary, mm-hmm. but one in which as it's being created, it's being deconstructed. And for me, it's a lot about the way that moment for me is the versions of masculinity mm-hmm. That are rendered in all of their made upness. Mm-hmm. So like the kind of mustaches that are painted on mm-hmm. And you know, the beards and the makeup that show manhood to be a fiction and a construction.
Right.
And so I think that that's you so nicely track the way in which drag in the history, in theater studies, in kind of postmodern thought is a at once a bad object, but also a kind of lusted after thought. You nicely kind of quote Munoz's idea of terrorist drag, but I guess I'm curious about how ambivalence maps on to drag. You have this nice quote about the kind of, you say, while drag's ability to foster agency is limited, the possibility of provisional resistance cannot be closed altogether. This frames drag as ambivalent at best, which is better than nothing.
Right. and so in each of the subjects, this plays out differently. So Nina Simone, I come up with the kind of idea of quadruple consciousness. I think of her kind of multiple excessive performance mode, which is very different from this. And the chapter on Gunter Kaufmann and the Afro-German actor who's in many Fassbinder films, I talk about a kind of radical ambivalence that's a part of that tradition of performance. Here, these people are interesting, to say the least. I mean, some people really are part of like the communal, the commune scene, right? Some people are actually using kind of rigid ideological frameworks to do that. Some people are just on acid and drifting from place to place. Some people are a part of, you know, new movements from the universities, maybe the new gay lib thing or anti-war stuff. Some people are not because they're just on acid. And you could talk then about gender in a similar way, right? And this is, you know, a while ago, a lot of the language we use to talk about gender hadn't been developed, and many of these people are deceased for a number of different reasons, so we wouldn't even know what they would say about their own genders at this point. But you can sort of suss out that some people are trans, some people are gay guys who like to dress up, some people are cisgender women who like to dress up, some people are both of those who like to take their clothes off, and maybe those categories shift. So it's the relationship to the kind of the way the communal model models certain kinds of Marxist forms. There is an ambivalent approach to that within this troupe. There's an ambivalent approach to gender. There's an ambivalent approach to representations of race, I would say, in that there's a consistent interest in reflecting the way race has been represented in American performance genres. Like the first Cockettes show that Sylvester saw was Gone with the Showboat to Oklahoma, which, you know, has blackface and whiteface and, you know, naked Scarlett O'Hara. And it's not just on stage. People are having sex in the audience. The sets are falling down. People are dancing around. People just come up and start singing. It's a whole sort of life as performance place. And the kind of both in relationship to a political orthodoxy, but in relationship to gender and race, I wouldn't describe this as like intersectionality in the sense that you have a set of identities that are fixed that then you bring into contact with each other. It has more to do with the kind of place of subjectivity that then plays out in really unstable ways. And so that in this chapter is maybe an example of how that ambivalence works. I noticed this time that Lyndon Sadler, who plays Mahalia Jackson, is like whipping everyone at the end and strangling people. Like some people are there to like bottom extraordinarily, but Lyndon is like, no, I'm gonna kill people, right? And Reggie, who is on the cover of the book, Reggie, AKA Anton Dunnigan, plays Eartha Kitt, who of course famously was black listed after speaking up at a White House ceremony with Lady Bird Johnson, speaking about the Vietnam War. Also is a top, you know, at this point. And Sylvester, of course, comes off as glamorous Sylvester, actually sings well, you know, like tries to kind of do bad, you know, tries to kind of like slum it with the Cockettes, but can actually sing the Coretta Scott King song, this like weird antique love song. And I mean, the last thing I'll say about that is there's a difference between the project of dropping out of the white middle class to become this San Francisco hippie and what many of the black performers are doing who had no sort of white middle class to drop out of, to transgress away from, are actually trying to produce something. And Sylvester, of course, goes on to a professional career. And Sylvester and Hibiscus like had fist fights over this.
The way in which blackness augments, exceeds, disrupts the ideology and techniques of communal living is so precise in your book. I mean, the idea of virtuosity as being a technique for the 60s runs counter to the received notions of what the avant-garde was in the 60s. I mean, I'm in Judson dance theater land, so virtuosity is not necessarily...
No, to virtuosity is like...
Totally. And I think the way that you track virtuosity in relationship to blackness, but also other forms of physical techniques of proficiency, like you use the word transvocality as a way of thinking about ambiguous gendering as a kind of skill set. You talk about the discipline and the way in which Sylvester works against the kind of anti-disciplinary apparatus of the group. And, you know, I think... what's interesting is that you don't put those things in relationship to kind of black respectability, right? Like there's still an antagonistic relationship to middle class black mores of the time, even while they are also, thickening the white middle class mores. So I guess, you know, just to think a little bit more, I mean, there's also that great moment where the groom goes like, right on, brother, and then you hear like, Eddie, please. So like there's a kind of, the dawning on of blackness by white subjects is also experimented with, but also withheld or itself refused off screen, off stage. So there's a lot happening in the way that you describe it.
Yeah, I mean, and this is something I'm working on still. Like, what is, you know, in queer theory especially, there's been a kind of thinking about failure as a mode outside of sort of the demands of straight productivity. And when I go back to figures like this, or, you know, there's other figures that I'm interested in, there still is this kind of production, and you can think about it in relationship to, you know, the demands for, you could bring a Marxist analysis to the kind of surplus value that is extracted from the productive and reproductive body of Black people. But you can also think about these kinds of performance traditions, right? These Black performance traditions where it's like more and more and more has to be achieved with the body. And you can also think about a kind of, you know, excess in even psychoanalytic terms, or, you know, any frame you want as something that kind of gets past the boundary. And I'm still like thinking about virtuosity as not what a kind of Italian violin tradition might want us to think about it as, but as a kind of Black technique that can sort of reframe the thinking about failure. Because like Sylvester, by doing nothing, he would fail, you know? some of the other people who dropped out have to like actively fail to transform the situation. But they're also doing a kind, like their relationship to the pure white ceremony is really interesting too. I mean, if you read, I go through the kind of news reports, the kind of newspaper articles about Trisha Nixon's dress, all of her clothing was in the newspaper all the time. And it's always this extremely feminized, extremely like sanctified, miniature petite baby's breath, cinched waist, baby lamb beret kind of white femininity. And the ceremony in the Rose Garden, which was the first one in the Rose Garden, I just looked this up. There have been a lot of White House weddings since the very beginning. And this was the first one that was in the Rose Garden, which has now become a thing. You know, the cake was really like that, but, you know, well done. And so it's this perfect, you know, confirmation of the hetero family order as the sort of miniature of the state, right? With the president as the father in the middle. And so what Goldie Glitters does to that is really sort of extraordinary. I mean, these are the people who are in the White House at the moment, right? Like that really is the first lady that is being portrayed. So there's a certain kind of bravery in taking on the kind of normative virtuosity of the state that I think is really extraordinary here.
Totally, and the proximity and, you know, the exactness of this in relationship to the real thing is pretty impressive. I mean, the fact that, as Molly Reinita said, it's like released the same day as the actual ceremony is kind of unbelievable, because there's certain things about the way that this plays itself out, like that like receiving line, mm-hmm. that look exactly like what's being televised, mm-hmm. which goes to what you're saying about, you know, the thing that people are watching itself being a kind of replica, yeah. that is kind of or is farcical or doesn't look real when you see this, because you realize, you know, it's like that Judith Butler thing of like, this looks like a copy when you copy it very yeah, explicitly. Uh-huh. Yeah. But particularly in relationship to whiteness. I mean, the way in which whiteface is differently mobilized across many of the white figures, I think also further complicates the things that you're saying in relationship to how whiteness in particular is the kind of paste or you know, costuming through which that version of American heteropatriarchy, US American heteropatriarchy can articulate itself. I mean, there's just so much, like so many like fake white people that are real white people. It's like starting with that beginning of the mother of the bride looking so ratchet with basically like putting splooge on her face, it looks like.
They're eating like ketchup in bed. It's like
and his nails are nasty. But like Mamie is in whiteface, Trisha's in whiteface, the child, the ring bearer, is like in like the most hyperbolic whiteface of like clown whiteface. The premier Georgia, the peach state guy. So, you know, thinking about legacies of minstrelsy and blackface that you invoke mm-hmm. in relationship to what the Coquettes are up to mm-hmm. here. How do you see, yeah, how do you see this kind of version of putting on white operating?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if you read, I mean, Pam Tent, one of the Coquettes, has a really good book. Bambi Lake's book is really good, and she spent a little time in, with the Coquettes. The David Weissman film is really good, if anyone has seen that or not. Joshua Gamson's biography of Sylvester is really good. And from the kind of main Coquettes thing, they're like, we don't, you know, race doesn't exist, gender doesn't exist, that's not a thing, you know, we're going to exaggerate it. And it's not exactly a kind of, you know, deep critique of race necessarily, but there is a strong attention to performing the genre of race, just like everything else. They do, you know, Busby Berkeley musicals, they make films from MGM costume sales, they do Chinese operas with fake Chinese, you know, like, and so it's not like a kind of a resource for, you know, woke politics necessarily, but there is an attention to the kinds of ways that race in the field of representation, if we can say that, performs itself as a genre like any other kind of genre. And then, you know, using these kind of carnivalesque strategies, this is like straight out of like Bakhtin, right? You show your lower body, bodies are all in groups and interchangeable, they go in and out of each other. There is a gay festive time, there is you know, the humor, there's reversal, inverted hierarchies, like, you know, all of these things are like straight off, check, check, check off the list of the carnivalesque. And so race becomes a part of that material in a really interesting way with this troupe. And I, you know, I think that Sylvester was interested in that, though Sylvester in Sylvester's records is, you know, Sylvester would tell people that he was related to Billie Holiday. You know, he was really interested in kind of moving forward a kind of black excellence, we can say, a black diva kind of position with integrity, but obviously chose to join this group.
There are just two moments I wanted to sit with and get your take on that were like troubling, but also productive. To use the word I used before. One is the Indira Gandhi moment, the kind of like brown face with like her blanket sari that she does. And I wondered if that was like a kind of read that you thought, like just given what she was doing mm-hmm. in terms of warfare in Pakistan at the time, and a kind of using of racial caricature to make fun of somebody who's basically trying to annex, you know, or separate from the rest of South Asia, the subcontinent at the time. And then also Mahalia Jackson, mm-hmm. who I think, you know, I don't know what her relationship is to kind of black Marxism, but, you know, I've talked a lot about her with my colleague, Anna Yanevsky, who grew up in the former Yugoslavia, and she talks a lot about how her father, like the one gospel singer that her father played in the house all the time was Mahalia Jackson. And, you know, my white French grandmother, you know, in Paris, who was affiliated with communist, was also listening to Mahalia Jackson. So I just wonder, like, those two moments that, you know, are particular in terms of their affect.
Yeah, that I didn't know about Mahalia Jackson. That's really interesting. I mean, you know, obviously she has some proximity to the, you know, Christian civil rights movement. And, you know, I would speculate that that's part of a kind of interest in communist places in the sort of black American worker as both this kind of ideal form of politicized worker, but also the symbol of, you know, capitalism's, you know, rapacious cruelty, right? So that's really interesting. Yeah, I don't know. And it's hard to, I think people intend different things. You know, I imagine some people are like, who do you want to dress up as? And they're like, I'm going to be Indira Gandhi. Wouldn't that be great? I don't know if there's a kind of attention span in the production process to even sort of answer that question about why, you know, why did these portrayals come together like that? And, you know, they're the Madame New character, you know, like these are not masquerades that we would do now, right? And so part of this space of ambivalence is that not everything feels good.
I want to take us back to a place where some things feel good historically, maybe not right now, but I guess the space that you're from, of California. you know, I think Nixon, if I'm not mistaken, is the only U.S. president who was born in California.
Well, Reagan was the governor, but he was not born there.
Right.
I have been to Nixon's library in Yorba Linda. It's really extraordinary.
What is it like?
It's like the 70s, and then there's a kind of depressing area about Watergate where it's like not his fault at all.
But you know, there's a way that California not only figures in this film, but also through, you know, the Cockettes and Sylvester. But what you do, interestingly, is you, as a way of kind of championing this, the space of aesthetics and culture, as one of discomfort in the way that you just described, you kind of shadow box with the BPP, and have this great quote by Elaine Brown at the kind of, as the epigraph of the chapter, that California offered itself to me. I mean, it's quite like kind of sexual language. It seemed to present the possibility of creating a life, of finding ease, you know. So there's a really interesting way that you both kind of take what is the kind of standard version of black radicalism in the 70s and kind of look at it from underneath, but then use that also to read something that doesn't totally necessarily sit next to. So I guess, I don't know, do you just want to talk about like Cali?
I think Elaine Brown says, I put it on like a glove. And you know, whenever there's like theatrical costumery, I'm like, all right, look at that. And in her biography, you know, she's one of these figures of the Black Panther Party. There's a lot of attention to her boots and, you know, stuff like that. And it's kind of one of my favorite parts of the book is I do this little detour from San Francisco using some moments where the Cockettes had appropriated, and this happens in Fassbinder, this happens everywhere. People appropriate scenes of Black Panther conflict and incorporate them into their work as kind of the sign of radicalism of the time. And I go from there across the bay to Oakland. I'm like, well, what are the Black Panthers doing in relationship to performing politics and the kind of pressure that puts on gender? And they don't have, you know, masquerade costumes, they have a uniform, right? And it's and they're not interested in the kind of dashiki, you know, African fantasy stuff, and they're much more interested in a kind of Maoist, you know, look, but a cool look with the leather jacket and the blue shirt and the little trousers and the large hair and a gun, right? And it's a pretty standard look. And interestingly, there are, you know, several of the key figures that we remember are women in that organization, and they were very important. And, you know, perhaps, I, you know, the thing you hear about the most of their legacy, other than the kind of spectacle that they stirred, was the breakfast program, right? Which women, of course, were very involved in. But, you know, so on paper, the Panthers had a kind of communist-inspired gender equality, right? And in practice, and when you listen to Erica Huggins or Elaine Brown, definitely Kathleen Cleaver, you don't see that exactly working out in practice all the time, but it's part of a kind of Marxist position they're taking. You could say that, like, that is like a kind of Maoist costume. You could also say it's like obliterating femininity or erasing women, or you could say it's kind of creating an equal gender space, and that's also ambivalent. You know, I look at Elaine Brown's album of propaganda songs that she made for the Black Panther Party, which has this beautiful Emery Douglas mural collage on the front, and, you know, her stirring song that is maybe the most memorable is when she returns to this chorus, believe it, my friends, that the silence can end, we'll just have to get guns and be men. And you hear, you have this, you know, woman and this kind of crystalline, kind of folky voice in this kind of plural first person saying we can become men by appropriating the phallic prop. And it's like messy, it's a big mess. But these obviously aren't equivalent. You know, another thing is pretty much everyone in this book is dead, and they kind of don't have to be, you know, they could, many of them could be of an age that it would be possible they would be alive still. But this era was hard, you know, and yeah, so Elaine Brown's living though. So these aren't equivalent, and you know, many Panthers and many Coquettes met very different kind of violent ends, and they're not equivalent categories, but I think it's interesting to see how people are using costume and voice and, you know, visuality around the kind of politicized movements of the time, and how a kind of black core functions in those.
Sticking with, I guess, one last question before we open up to the audience, which is about the gambit of the book overall, which is about this idea of the excessive 60s, which is so nice. You know, there's all these kind of like the long 60s and, you know, all these very like empirical versions of periodization that the excessive 60s, which you borrow from, or you kind of riff off of Barack Obama, nicely puts some pressure on. But I, you know, I'm thinking Huey Copeland gave a really great talk at the Guggenheim about the way in which certain white artists who kind of are using political aesthetics from the 60s differ from some of the kind of Afro futurist ways in which Sun Ra and other folks kind of are retooled in contemporary art practice. And I think there's actually something really true that you could extend beyond just the terms of speculative fiction that have to do specifically with the ways in which the 60s, as you describe it, is a kind of ongoing or unfinished project. Yeah. And I'm thinking here, you know, just to like throw some cards down, like there's, I think, a way that, you know, Cyprian Gaillard, you know, for example, is one figure who kind of thinks about the 60s, that kind of nostalgic space in which one can revive modernism, versus other folks who think about the failures of the 60s as its space of possibility. Yeah. So I'm thinking here of like John Acomfra or Cameron Rowland, and you and your book, the way in which the kinds of spaces of things not being realized are actually their site of possibility. So I wonder, yeah, if you could just talk.
And My Barbarian, I would say. Oh, wait, I want that
with Alex Sagata. Yes, I think. Well, you're in your artistic practice, you're deeply invested in that.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I agree with you. And the short thing I would say about that is, I see this kind of idea. When Obama said in an interview, you know, something about the excesses of the 60s, and part of the idea of the 60s as this out of control radical space is the idea that it ended and a closure happened and authority reinstituted itself and now we're safe from it. The last section tracks some performances from the Venice Biennale in 2015 and the ways this unruly energy continues and, you know, produces ambivalent results. It somehow we never work our way into a utopian, you know, workers world state where we all share resources perfectly. But there's something else there.
Should we open up to the audience for questions?
Does anybody have a question?
Or comments? A song.
I really enjoyed hearing you two speak about the film, and I wondered, it was so striking to me how much the film is almost shot for shot, particularly towards the end, Jack Smith's Flaming Creatures, obviously, and then the audio particularly is almost track for track exactly from the orgy scene with the moans and then sort of like country music overlay. Could you just speak about that particular collision of like the political and then the sort of, you know, extremely avant-garde?
I think that was just a huge inspiration for these people. The Coquettes formed around a like movie, late night movie show at the Palace Theater where they would show Flaming Creatures and other, you know, Kenneth Anger, and then they would show, like, you know, 30s musicals, and they would just go late at night. And then one time they did a floor show at the beginning of the night, and that turned into this project. So Flaming Creatures was important to them. It's like a model. You know, it's dedicated to Divine, which I somehow didn't remember. You know, the whole Divine showed up, you know, in full attire on an airplane one time, and they all with conga drums greeted her at the airport and brought her into the fold. And John Waters in that movie says that was the first time outside of Baltimore anyone ever took anything seriously that he did. And so I think this was a kind of counterculture support network, and they obviously don't have strict ideas about authorship. Yeah. But of course Jack Smith precedes all of these things in a really impressive way. Yeah, let's wrap it up. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Feel free to stick around and have a drink. Thanks again, Malik and Thomas. And buy the book.